Good day. All sites are now online in the listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. You may enter the question queue at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. It's now my pleasure to hand off the conference to your moderator, Stuart Anderson. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. My name is Stuart Anderson, Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy, which is a nonpartisan public policy research organization started in 2003, focusing primarily on trade and immigration. We're releasing a report today on the high denial rates for L1 and H1B petitions at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and the study can be found on our website at www.nfap.com. Now, this is one of these classic issues that is, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's probably a 15 for many companies. This is a huge issue, that really doesn't get reported very much because for among the general populace, they're probably not even aware, that there is this issue of denials and people not being able to get in as they've been in the past been able to if they're skilled professionals. And what we had found is that there were a lot of anecdotes going on particularly among companies and immigration attorneys that they'd found it was just getting much more difficult to get their petitions approved at U.S. Immigration Services, and also finding that that also there's a problem abroad as well. We had found that the number of L1 visas, which are used for intercompany transfers, had fallen by more than 20% between 2010 and 2011. At the same time, you had seen a rise for the rest of the world. So that was a report released a few months ago, but that only was telling part of the story. We didn't really think it was telling all of it, particularly when it came to what was happening at the Immigration Service. Now, what we were able to do is get data from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services that reveal that there has been a dramatic increase in denials of L1 and H-1B petitions over the past 4 years. And I think there's quite a bit of evidence that we'll hear later on the call about this has had a negative effect on competitiveness of U.S. employers and encouraging companies to keep more jobs and resources outside the United States. Now, the data indicate that much of the increase involves Indian-born professionals and researchers. Now, one of the things that really we found in the research is that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service adjudicators have demonstrated a capacity to keep skilled foreign nationals out of the country through significantly increasing these denials, along with time-consuming what are called requests for evidence, or RFEs. And this has happened despite no change in the law or relevant regulations between 2008 and 2011. Now, let me explain what requests for evidence are. It's when a USCIS adjudicator asks for more information from a petitioner or usually a company when they're asking for to bring in a skilled worker or have their change the status of such a worker who's already in the country. And that's instead of making an immediate decision. It can often scuttle the petition altogether if the person needs to be in a particular time frame because it can take months. So in some ways, these requests for evidence can be as bad as a denial for those involved. And the evidence indicates that adjudicators or others at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services changed the standard for approving L-1B and other petitions in recent years, beginning in 2008 and 2009. Here's one way to look at this, at these figures. If one considers that in FY 2011, 63% of all L-1B petitions, which are used to transfer in skilled employees, that 63% of all L-1B petitions received a request for evidence and 27% were issued a denial. That means U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services adjudicators denied or delayed between 63% to 90% of all L-1B petitions in 2011. Now, the high denial rates belie the notion that adjudications have become more lenient, as some have alleged. Employers report the time lost due to the increase in denials and requests for evidence are costing them millions of dollars in project delays and contract penalties, and certainly hurting them with their competitors who are abroad and don't have to deal with these kind of personnel delays. And you should note that the data in the report includes only petitions at USCIS, not decisions made at consular posts. Now, one of the interesting things about these denial rates and requests for evidence, which I'm going to get to the specific numbers in a moment, is that you have to think about the pool of applicants that are being denied. Generally, it's a very stratified sample you're talking about. I mean, employers, because of the costs and resources involved and time, employers are only going to generally put forward people for these types of petitions if they think there's a reasonable chance that they're going to get approved. So this is not a random sample. These are people who companies already believe would meet the standard for approval. Now, denying employers the ability to transfer key personnel or gain entry for skilled professionals, either in H-1Bs or Ls, as we'll hear later in the call, is likely to harm innovation and job creation in the United States, and it's going to encourage more employers to keep resources outside the country. And I think the lack of predictability is one key factor here. Now, the denial rates for L-1B petitions, and again, these are used to transfer employees into the country who are already working for the employer abroad, and these are people who have what are called specialized knowledge. Now, the denial rates were at 7% in FY 2007, and they rose to 22% in FY 2008, despite no change in the law or relevant regulation. The denial rate stayed high for L-1B petitions at 26% in 2009, and they were 22% in 2010 and 27% in 2011. And as I noted, that the requests for evidence have skyrocketed as well. In other words, that means the adjudicators are if they're not denying immediately or not approving immediately, they're requesting this additional information, which delays the application for potentially months. Interestingly, the request for additional evidence for L-1B petitions was only 2% of the cases back in 2004. Only 2% of the cases were the request for evidence, and it rose to 17% in 2007, 49% in 2008, and by 2011, it reached a level of 63% of the cases. So, again, if you look at the range between the denials and the request for evidence, even though some of the requests for evidence may have later been denied, you're looking at a range of between 63% to 90% of all the cases having some type of delay or denial on them. If you look at H-1B petitions, the denial rate for H-1B petitions increased from 11% in FY 2007 to 29% in FY 2009 and remained higher than the past for H-1Bs at 21% in 2010 and 17% in 2011. And again, the request for evidence have increased significantly from a low of 4% in 2004 up to 35% by 2009 and 26% of the cases had requests for evidence in 2011. L-1A petitions, which are to transfer in people with who are managers and executives, those denials increased from 8 to 14% between 2007 and 2011. But the request for evidence actually went from 4% in 2004 up to 51% in 2011. So even when transferring managers and executives, when the denial rates have not been as high as the other categories, it's interesting, like more than half the cases, there's a request for evidence. And one thing I would say on the request for evidence is I took a look at the adjudicator's field manual for USCIS, and under point two, when it talks about considerations prior to issuing RFEs, request for evidence, it says RFE should, if possible, be avoided. And then it talks about why. But apparently that advice from the field manual is not being observed. Now, the denial rates also increase for O1A petitions, which are used for individuals with extraordinary ability in the sciences, education, business, or athletics. Went from 4% in 2008 up to 10% by 2009. And the request for evidence, again, also increased, going from 1% in 2004 up to 27% in 2011. Now, there's separate data here, and I should note that when we're talking about this, again, it's for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services data. That what happens is when someone normally will have to go through USCIS to get their petition approved, except in some cases for an L-1 visa, where people are able to get what's called blanket petitions, larger companies often, and they would then go straight to the consulate. But generally speaking, if you want to work in the United States, either an H-1B or L visa, you're going to have to at some point come in touch with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Now, we'd gotten some separate data, and then I'll wrap up here, that I wanted to share with you, that only focused on the initial applications for L-1B petitions. Again, these are people with specialized knowledge that are being transferred into the United States to work. This was country-specific data that wasn't available for the broader overall, which included both initial and extensions. And on the country-specific data for new initial L-1B petitions, it revealed that much of the discussion we're having about denial rates seems to be centered on India and cases being denied involving Indians. And we found that the data actually showed that L-1B petitions rose from 2.8% earlier in 2008 up to over 22% just a year later in 2009. So again, you're looking at a nearly tenfold increase, 8 to 10-fold increase in just 1 year period, with no change in the law or regulation. Now, in comparison, during that same time period, Canadians, only their denial rate for L-1B petitions only rose from 2% to 2.9%. So we find, and I think you'll hear this from companies, that they see the problem centered primarily on cases that are not getting approved involving people from India. And I think the final point to make here is that the dramatic increase in denial rates and requests for evidence for employment petitions has taken place without any change in the law or regulations, and it raises questions about the training, supervision, and procedures of the career bureaucracy that adjudicates petitions, and also raises questions about the U.S. government's commitment to maintaining a stable business climate for companies competing in the global economy. Now, at this point, I'd like to turn over to our two speakers, and who represent two of the most important organizations in the country when it comes to immigration policy. First, we'll hear from Randy Johnson, who is Senior Vice President, Labor, Immigration, and Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Randy has been involved in all the key immigration policy issues and debates in recent years. And prior to coming to the Chamber, he worked for 6 years as an attorney with the U.S. Department of Labor, where he was Special Assistant to the Solicitor of Labor for Regulatory Affairs. Randy?
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. And who would ever guess there'd be so much angst over two words called specialized knowledge. But that's where we are. And, you know, I was listening to your stats, Stuart, and thinking, you know, there's statistics. There's an old saying, there's statistics and damn statistics. And what that means is, you know, in some cases, statistics can be manipulated to reach a certain result. But that is not the case here. The pattern here is quite clear. For some reason, which we can't figure out, the rate of denials have increased. And I can tell certainly the people on the press that the companies that are submitting these applications are not fly-by-night companies they know how to prepare a file, they know how to prepare an application for a visa, and they hire top flight lawyers, and they employ smart people to do these applications right. So it's not a situation of where perhaps the agency might argue that, oh, all of a sudden the filings are now sloppy, and so that's why they're being denied. I can assure you that that's not the case. So we have a pattern here that Stewart's laid out, and we can't figure out really what is going on. Has the standard changed, and we don't know why or what? And so is this a big deal? Oh, I can tell you, I've been doing this for about 10 years at the Chamber on immigration and many other issues, but and while companies will weigh in on things like comprehensive immigration reform or H-1Bs, this is one of these areas that is typically quite technical and wouldn't really rise to the Chamber's attention. But as Stewart indicated, there's such a breakdown now over at DHS on this issue that the companies have now said, look, this is a problem. This is hurting our ability to expand and compete in America and overseas. And what can we do about it? So this is not sort of a typical case of whining about a bureaucratic process. As Stewart indicated, this has really reached almost a fever pitch among our membership. Now, why? Well, look, this is really about companies who are producing a product here in the United States, but they're often working with their international talent overseas who are jointly working on a production. And in some cases, they want to say, hey, look, let me bring over my team from X country to work with the team here in America so we can get this product done, whatever it might be. It might be a complicated piece of machinery. It might be a piece of software. And whereas in the past those companies could bring those people in, now they're being held up or denied. And the result of that is this production gets held up. What are companies going to do? Well, they're going to work through the system, hire more lawyers, and eventually get approved. Or they're going to at some point say, well, we've got to get this done. We'll move overseas. Fortunately, that's not high on the list. And so we none of us want to get there. So better to figure out what is going on here and get a solution to it. I mean, it's even a situation where you may have someone with specialized knowledge who's been approved in the process prior, and they're in the country, this is a true case, working in the country on a specialized product, but the renewal comes up, and so they go back to DHS and submit their application for renewal, the same person, and DHS is, well, all of a sudden now we don't think this person has specialized knowledge, and so submit us a whole bunch of other information with regard to this individual. We had one where this person had like 7 patents relevant to the area of being the specialized knowledge. So did the company work through that finally? Yeah, it did. But that's opportunity cost in terms of new lawyers being hired and delays in production. So it's a murky bureaucratic area. I've spent my time in the agencies, like Department of Labor, as Stewart indicated, and I get how the system can be bogged down and the difficulty in moving people. But we've got to figure out a solution to this, or it's going to hurt, frankly, the ability of our companies to keep jobs in America and to compete, and that's the last thing we need in this environment. These are real stories. They're having a significant effect on these companies, and we've got to figure out what this proper solution is. So with that, I'll turn it over to Crystal, who I know has more of sort of a perspective on some of the smaller employer experiences in this area. Crystal?
Thanks, Randy. I'm with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and this is an organization of close to 12,000 attorneys who, on a day-to-day basis, deal with the various agencies that administer the immigration laws. Over the past few years, we've developed a new word or a new phrase for the standard that under which applications and petitions are being adjudicated. It's called MSU, which stands for Making Stuff Up. The fact is that we don't know what the standards are anymore for H-1s or L-1s because it's a moving target. There is a very comprehensive set of regulations, a pretty comprehensive set of guidance memos that have come out over the years that we thought made pretty clear what the standards are. However, what we are seeing is requests for evidence and denials incorporating standards that don't appear in any of that. And the interesting part is that these standards seem to be particularly aimed at entrepreneurs. For example, when an L-1 transferee, an executive who wants to start up a business in the United States or has a business in the United States and wants to continue it, applies either for an initial petition or for an extension, the answer now is, gosh, you only have 10 employees. And even though everything you just gave me says that you're doing the work of an executive, you can't possibly be an executive because you only have 10 employees. So what happens to that company? Well, guess what? Those 10 employees lose their jobs. Those are 10 U.S. workers who have lost their jobs because USCIS adjudicators seem to be taken with the notion that you have to have a certain number of employees to be an executive. And what this happens is it kills new businesses. And by killing new businesses, which are the source of most jobs in America, it's killing jobs in the United States. Now, I'm not going to blame the adjudicators on the ground. The fact is, the law rests responsibility for deciding these cases with the Secretary of Homeland Security. She, in turn, delegates that to the director of USCIS, who, in turn, delegates it down through at least 5 different layers until you get to an adjudicator who is often at a GS-7 or a GS-9 level. In other words, kind of rank-and-file person making these decisions. And for reasons that I really can't comprehend, it has become a standard belief within USCIS that those people in those higher layers cannot interfere or involve themselves in the decision-making made by the GS-7 adjudicator. And so what is left is that people on the ground are indeed making up standards, and there's no control over it. The administration has issued a number of initiatives to try to encourage entrepreneurs and encourage entrepreneur immigrants. But unfortunately, until the actual standards for adjudications get addressed, we're going to continue with the MSU standard, and we're going to continue to see the kinds of denials and requests for evidence that bog down the system now. And then you say, okay, so, somebody rank and file has made this decision, but there's an appeal process. You can go to the Administrative Appeals Office. Certainly you can. The Administrative Appeals Office takes, on average, 2 years to get to an appeal on an H or an L. Now, we've heard promises that they're hiring and they're going to speed that up, but we've heard those promises before. Back in 2005, the appeal fee, which was at that time $110, was more than tripled to $385. And at that time, there were a lot of promises that money was going to be used to increase the staff of the AAO and therefore increase the speed of appeals. Now, here we are in 2012, and actually the appeal fee now is $630. Interestingly, in 2005, when that promise was made, the average length of an appeal was 12 months, was a year. And at that time, that was unacceptable, too, because no business can wait a year for a key personnel. Well, now the wait is 2 years. The fee is 6 times higher, and the wait is twice as long. So, sorry, we're not buying the we're going to build that up. The fact is there's no place to go if you get one of these denied, and way too many of these are being denied. So what do the companies do? They take their project, they take their company, they go overseas. They shut down the project, and all of that, all of those jobs that went with that project are gone. They've gone into the atmosphere. The fact is immigrant entrepreneurs built a good part of the business of this country, and yet because of standards that are being made up as they go along, those entrepreneurs are being barred from entry into the United States to start their businesses, to continue their businesses, to create jobs. This has to stop.
Thank you, Crystal. I think that's an interesting perspective because normally, the smaller business folks are just not as involved in the immigration process in terms of, speaking out in the media, for example. So that was interesting to hear. And what Randy was relating, and we can get into it more in the Q&A, is what the companies, the larger companies, are saying. Well, let's open it up for questions now, and see, and continue the discussion.
Certainly, sir. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, simply press the star and one on your touchtone phone to enter the question queue. You may withdraw yourself at any time by pressing the pound key. Once more, that's star one to ask a question. And our first question comes to us from Aziz Hanifa from India Abroad. Go ahead, please. Your line is open.
Yeah, Stuart, this question is for you and the other panelists. What would you say describes this discrepancy when it comes to Indians? Is it sort of a no-brainer because Indians constitute the highest number of H-1B applicants, or is there something a little more sinister behind it? And in terms of the L-1 visas, what would you say is also due to this discrepancy? Is it something deliberate?
Well, it's certainly a good question, and let me just reiterate what I said earlier about the data. I basically have two sets of data from USCIS, one which has overall rates, and then a second one which only deals with initial applications, not extensions. Which we were able to break down the country-specific data. And when you break down the country-specific data, you see much higher denial rates for Indian applicants and this was for L visas, L-1B visas, particularly which are for specialized knowledge. Again, it's the rate that's different, so that's much higher. So it's not just the total denials being higher. But I would say this about... So it's really the percentage that we're looking at. And I would say this is that it's been a more recent phenomenon because, as I point out, that the denial rate was closer to 2% in 2008, and then you were looking at over 20% just a year later when it comes to transferring people in with specialized knowledge. It's hard to speculate exactly why this has happened. I think the most important thing is to get more acknowledgement from the U.S. government that this is happening, that there is this disparity, that it's not just anecdotes. As I mentioned in the paper, when in the past, people from the federal government on this issue have said things like, "Well, the denials, it's more a matter of perception." But these are hard facts that comes from the government itself that shows denial rates have increased significantly. I'll let Randy and Crystal see if they want to take a shot at why they think the rates appear to be much higher for India in terms of denials.
I will say, early at some point last year there was a conference called by the Ombudsman for USCIS. And one of the panelists at that conference told a story of an employer that she was representing that submitted 5 L-1B petitions. 3 were approved, 2 were denied, and they were all pretty much identical. Interestingly, the 3 that were approved were Europeans. The 2 that were denied were Indian. I don't know, and I don't want to impute motives on people that aren't there, but that is an anecdote that we seem to be hearing time and time again. And so when Stuart issued provided these stats, it seemed to confirm what we had the impression of what has been going on. And I don't know if it's a conscious bias or if it's an unconscious bias, but there does certainly appear to be a bias there.
Randy, I mean, if you could comment just on the fact,
and there's certainly, I don't want to use the word, it certainly begs explanation, but I'm not going to speculate on the possible explanation.
But I would say is that since, given the you know, given the, you know, that so many of the larger companies do have operations in India, I think it's fair to say that this is one reason this issue has bubbled up so much, that they're seeing the denials and requests for evidence on many, many applications from India. Is that correct to say?
No, that's true. And, you know, Chris, we may want to comment on the fact this is not just a CIS issue, because we are talking about, you know, denials at the consulates in Chennai
right.
and stuff. And I think that's important to indicate this is a two-pronged agency problem, which also makes it more difficult to solve.
Yeah, and that is an important point. Although, you know, the stats in this study concentrate on USCIS
right.
information, what we are hearing and has been acknowledged by the State Department is that there has been a marked increase in denials, particularly of L-1Bs, at the consulate, because people, companies can apply under a blanket where they don't have to go through USCIS. And we've seen a marked increase, particularly in the number of denials under blankets at the consulate. And we're still struggling to get an answer as to why, but indeed, it's a phenomenon that spreads not just USCIS, but also State Department.
I've got a quick follow-up. Is this sort of a consequence and a reaction, a sort of defensive reaction to legislation by the likes of Senator Durbin, Grassley, and others? Because they've been insinuating fraud, et cetera, in H-1Bs and L-1s.
Well, look, agencies are supposed to be governed by the law, and hopefully they're not reacting to the possibility of some piece of legislation that might pass on the Hill at some point, because if they were, then no one would know what standards anybody is using. So I hope that's not the case. It would certainly be improper if that's a factor the agency is looking at, because that's not what the law is about. It's about specialized knowledge and whether or not someone has specialized knowledge.
And I think Randy's point there is a good one about a reliability. I mean, one of the hallmarks of a good economy, whatever the country is and whatever the state is that there's a reliability for the actors in the economy. To the extent that you get wild fluctuations in what are, you know, and legal standards, those kind of things tend to be associated with economies that don't perform as well, because there's not a reliability there for making investments that go, you know, that are medium or long term. And that's one of the concerns here, that you get a lack of reliability in terms of being able to establish long term business ties that encourage employers to find just other ways to deal with these things, which is, quite frankly, not doing as much business in the United States. We can take the next question.
And just a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, star one if you do have a question. And I'm showing no further questions at this time, sir.
Well, let me ask Crystal to just elaborate on the process so people understand here on the difference between, like, you know, how when does someone get involved with USCIS versus the State Department on these different visa categories?
Generally, if the individual is outside the United States, on the H-1B and on most of the L-1s, the company files a petition with USCIS. If USCIS approves that petition, then the approval is sent to the consulate where the person is located, and that person goes to the consulate and applies for a visa and comes into the United States. If the person is in the United States already under some other visa, particularly you'll find this, say, with student visas for H-1Bs, or somebody who's here on a business visitor visa who's been scoping out starting up a business, for example, then they go to USCIS and apply for a change of status, and so they don't go to the consulate at all. Some people, for larger companies, they can get a blanket L-1, which basically says that we're going to transfer a fair number of people here, and so USCIS, if they approve the blanket, then any subsidiaries or related companies abroad who are listed on the blanket can send their transferees directly into the consulate, and the transferee can apply for a visa without going through USCIS. So there's a couple of different processes depending on what the situation is. But except for the blanket, USCIS has a hand in all of the processes.
Okay. And so that's why, and that reiterates why, you know, this issue is so important when you've seen, you know, very large increase in denials. And in many cases, and I don't know if Crystal or Randy want to comment on this, how the request for evidence can be, you know, and just as bad as a denial.
In business, delay can be deadly. And interestingly, USCIS charges $1,000 if you want your petition considered within 15 days. And so many businesses pay that $1,000 because 15 days is a standard business period. Once a request for evidence issues, then that's automatically delay built in. Some of these requests for evidence go on for pages and pages, asking for documentation that sometimes doesn't exist, sometimes was already submitted, and quite frequently has nothing to do with standards, the legal standards for the petition. So therefore, the company is set off on wild goose chases to track down all of this documentation and get it to USCIS, even though they don't know why they're submitting it, because it doesn't relate to any standard. This also becomes very expensive for them. They already are paying filing fees of upwards of $1,500. They often have attorneys and are paying those attorneys, because this stuff is very, very complex. And it just extends the amount of expense and time that it takes. And eventually, and we've seen this with a number of cases, that the delays become so extensive that the need for the project passes. They lose a contract. They lose business. They just decide, what the heck, I'm not going to do this in the United States. Canada's looking mighty good to me right now. So delay in the business world, business needs to be nimble, much more nimble than government is. And in the business world, delay is as good as denial.
Okay. Now, if there are no other questions, I think we'll...
Actually, sir, it does appear we have a question from Kevin Johnson with USA Today. Go ahead, please. Okay. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Just to go back to the earlier question on the number of I know this looked at the rate of denials,
mm-hmm.
but I would be curious to know, you know, what percentage of the request of the applications come from India, as opposed to, you know, as part of the universe of these applicants.
I can get you that specifically. When you look at the data I have that's country specific, only deals with initial or new applications.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, you were looking at close to half of the L1B petitions,
mm-hmm.
for transferring people in with specialized knowledge were actually Indian-based. In other words, the
mm-hmm.
individual was born in India. The percentage actually dropped over the past year or so in the data as employers, I guess, to an extent, like any of us, decided not to keep hitting their head against a wall,
mm-hmm.
and started to figure out whether they'll just keep the people outside the country and move more of the work outside the country.
So it was close to half when?
I'll get you the exact data. I don't want to,
uh-huh.
but you know, just in like 2008, 2009, 2010, I'll get you the more exact data. There's two separate data. One's on the initials and one's on the overall. So I want to make sure I get you the right data set.
And is there anything within the request for additional information or in the denials that indicate reasoning for denial, whether it's a security issue, on and on? I mean, is there anything that requires a reasoning for that?
Crystal, maybe you could jump in on that.
We see virtually no security issue denials coming out of. Now, I'm speaking anecdotally. I don't have stats on this, but I hear from a lot of our members about it. Virtually no security issues coming out of India. The main issues that we see are the small business issues. In other words, you saying to the entrepreneurs, you can't possibly be a specialist, you can't possibly be a manager.
So the questioning their credentials pretty much more than anything?
Questioning their credentials or questioning the job itself and whether the job itself merits a visa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Crystal, one thing my members, this is Randy, it's moved from a specialized knowledge if you've got more than two people in a huge corporation that has that level of knowledge, that means it can't be specialized.
Uh-huh.
So what we get, and I can't give you the stats of it, but it's certainly more than a few companies have reported that the adjudicator is looking at sort of this number, and it's like, oh, well, how many other people could do that job in the company? And sure, if it's like hundreds, then maybe that brings into question. But we've had some reports that it's three people in a large company can do that. Well, it must not be specialized. So that's certainly my impression is kind of a new test that's been injected into the review process.
It
seems unreasonable, at least to me. But
it actually is counter to a change in law going way back to 1990, when that prior to 1990 that was close to the test, and Congress deliberately changed the standards in 1990 to make them broader. And yet, we actually see in these decisions the pre-1990 standards being cited rather than the standards that came into existence in 1990.
Yeah, okay.
Stuart, I think I need to jump off.
Great. If there are no other questions, I'd like to thank everyone for participating in the call and to Randy and Crystal for sharing their thoughts. Again, the report is available on our website at www.nfap.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stuart. Great report.
And ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.